security if they're already protected by two layers of fence, one of which is electrified and a few layers of guards, but this is not my world to question. No, this is not my world at all. Triss touches my shoulder and points down the long entryway. Look at that. Standing at the far end of the room, outside the security checkpoint, is a huge block of stone with a glass apparatus suspended above it. It's a clear example of the things we will see here that we don't understand. I also don't understand the hunger in Triss's eyes, devouring everything around us as if it alone can sustain her. Sometimes I feel like we are the same, but sometimes, like right now, I feel the separation between our personalities like I've just run into a wall. Christina says something to Triss and they both grin. Everything I hear is muffled and distorted. Are you all right? Kara asks me. Yeah, I say automatically. You know, it would be perfectly logical for you to be panicking right now, she says. No need to continually insist upon your unshakable masculinity. My what? She smiles and I realize that she was joking. All the people at the security checkpoint step aside, forming a tunnel for us to walk through. Ahead of us, Zoe announces, Weapons are not allowed inside this facility, but if you leave them at the security checkpoint, you can pick them up as you exit, if you choose to do so. After you drop them off, we'll go through the scanners and be on our way. That woman is irritating, Kara says. What? I say. Why? She can't separate herself from her own knowledge, she says as she draws her weapon. She keeps saying things like they're obvious when they are not, in fact, obvious. You're right, I say without conviction. That is irritating. Ahead of me, I see Zoe putting her gun into a gray container and then walking into a scanner. It is a man-sized box with a tunnel through the middle, just wide enough for a body. I draw my own gun, which is heavy with unused bullets, and put it in the container the security guard holds out to me, where all the others' guns are. I watch Zoe go through the scanner, then Amar, Peter, Caleb, Kara, and Christina. As I stand at the edge of it, at the walls that will squeeze my body between them, I feel the beginnings of panic again, the numb hands and the tight chest. The scanner reminds me of the wooden box that traps me in my fear landscape, squeezing my bones together. I cannot, will not panic here. I force my feet to move into the scanner and stand in the middle where all the others stood. I hear something moving in the walls on either side of me, and then there's a high-pitched beep. I shudder, and all I can see is the guard's hand motioning me forward. It is now okay to escape. I stumble out of the scanner, and the air opens up around me. Kara gives me a pointed look but doesn't say anything. When Triss takes my hand after going through the scanner herself, I barely feel it. I remember going through my fear landscape with her, our bodies pressed together in the wooden box that enclosed us, my palm against her chest feeling her heartbeat. It's enough to ground me in reality again. Once Uriah is through, Zoe waves us forward again. Beyond the security checkpoint, the facility is not as dingy as it was before. The floors are still tile, but they are polished to perfection, and there are windows everywhere. Down one long hallway, I see rows of lab tables and computers, and it reminds me of Erudite headquarters, but it's brighter here, and nothing seems to be hidden. Zoe leads us down a darker passageway on the right. As we walk past people, they stop to watch, and I feel their eyes on me like little beams of heat, making me warm from throat to cheeks. We walk for a long time deeper into the compound, and then Zoe stops, facing us. Behind her is a large circle of blank screens, like moths circling a flame. People within the circle sit at low desks, typing furiously on still more screens, these ones facing out instead of in. It's a control room, but it's out in the open, and I'm not sure what they're observing here, since all the screens are dark. Clustered around the screens that face in are chairs and benches and tables, like people gather here to watch at their leisure. A few feet in front of the control room is an older man wearing a smile and a dark blue uniform, just like all the others. When he sees us approaching, he spreads his hands as if to welcome us. David, I assume. This, the man says, is what we've waited for since the very beginning.
Chapter 15. Triss. I take the photograph from my pocket. The man in front of me, David, is in it, next to my mother. His face a little smoother, his middle a little trimmer. I cover my mother's face with my fingertip. All the hope growing inside me has withered. If my mother, or my father, or my friends were still alive, they would have been waiting by the doors for our arrival. I should have known better than to think what happened with Amar, whatever it was, could happen again. My name is David. As Zoe probably told you already, I am the leader of the Bureau of Genetic Welfare. I'm going to do my best to explain things, David says. The first thing you should know is that the information Edith Pryor gave you is only partly true. At the name Pryor, his eyes settle on me. My body shakes with anticipation. Ever since I saw that video, I've been desperate for answers, and I'm about to get them. She provided only as much information as you needed to meet the goals of our experiments, says David. And in many cases, that meant oversimplifying, omitting, and even outright falsehood. Now that you are here, there is no need for any of those things. You all keep talking about experiments, Tobias says. What experiments? Yes, well, I was getting to that. David looks at Amar. Where did they start when they explained it to you? Doesn't matter where you start. You can't make it easier to take, Amar says, picking at his cuticles. David considers this for a moment, then clears his throat. A long time ago, the United States government... The United what? Uriah asks. It's a country, says Amar. A large one. It has specific borders and its own governing body, and we're in the middle of it right now. We can talk about it later. Go ahead, sir. David presses his thumb into his palm and massages his hand, clearly disconcerted by all the interruptions. He begins again. A few centuries ago, the government of this country became interested in enforcing certain desirable behaviors in its citizens. There had been studies that indicated that violent tendencies could be partially traced to a person's genes. A gene called the murder gene was the first of these. But there were quite a few more. Genetic predispositions toward cowardice, dishonesty, low intelligence. All the qualities, in other words, that ultimately contribute to a broken society. We were taught that the factions were formed to solve a problem. The problem of our flawed natures. Apparently, the people David is describing, whoever they were, believed in that problem too. I know so little about genetics. Just what I can see passed down from parent to child, in my face and in friends' faces. I can't imagine isolating a gene from murder, or cowardice, or dishonesty. Those things seem too nebulous to have a concrete location in a person's body. But I'm not a scientist. Obviously, there are quite a few factors that determine personality, including a person's upbringing and experiences, David continues. But, despite the peace and prosperity that had reigned in this country for nearly a century, it seemed advantageous to our ancestors to reduce the risk of these undesirable qualities showing up in our population by correcting them. In other words, by editing humanity. That's how the genetic manipulation experiment was born. It takes several generations for any kind of genetic manipulation to manifest, but people were selected from the general population in large numbers, according to their backgrounds or behavior, and they were given the option to give a gift to our future generations, a genetic alteration that would make their descendants just a little bit better. I look around at the others. Peter's mouth is puckered with disdain. Caleb is scowling. Kara's mouth has fallen open, like she is hungry for answers and intends to eat them from the air. Christina just looks skeptical, one eyebrow raised, and Tobias is staring at his shoes. I feel like I am not hearing anything new. Just the same philosophy that spawned the factions, driving people to manipulate their genes instead of separating into virtue-based groups. I understand it. On some level, I even agree with it. But I don't know how it relates to us, here, now. But when the genetic manipulations began to take effect, the alterations had disastrous consequences. As it turns out, the attempt had resulted not in corrected genes, but in damaged ones, David says. Take away someone's fear, or low intelligence, or dishonesty, and you take away their compassion. Take away someone's aggression, and you take away their motivation, or their ability to assert themselves. Take away their selfishness, and you take away their sense of self-preservation. If you think about it, I'm sure you know exactly what I mean. I tick off each quality in my mind as he says it. Fear, low intelligence, dishonesty, aggression, selfishness. He is talking about the factions. And he's right to say that every faction loses something when it gains a virtue. The dauntless, brave but cruel. The erudite, intelligent but vain. The amity, peaceful but passive. The candor, honest but inconsiderate. The abnegation, selfless but stifling. Humanity has never been perfect, but the genetic alterations made it worse than it had ever been before. This manifested itself in what we call the Purity War, a civil war waged by those with damaged genes against the government and everyone with pure genes. The Purity War caused a level of destruction formerly unheard of on American soil, eliminating almost half of the country's population. The visual is up, says one of the people at a desk in the control room. A map appears on the screen above David's head. It is an unfamiliar shape, so I'm not sure what it's supposed to represent, but it's covered with patches of pink, red, and dark crimson lights. This is our country before the Purity War, David says, and this is after. The lights start to recede, the patches shrinking like puddles of water drying in the sun. Then I realize that the red lights were people. People disappearing, their lights going out. I stare at the screen, unable to wrap my mind around such a substantial loss. David continues, when the war was finally over, the people demanded a permanent solution to the genetic problem. And that is why the Bureau of Genetic Welfare was formed. Armed with all the scientific knowledge at our government's disposal, our predecessors designed experiments to restore humanity to its genetically pure state. They called for genetically damaged individuals to come forward so that the Bureau could alter their genes. The Bureau then placed them in secure environments to settle in for the long haul, equipped with basic versions of the serums to help them control their society. They would wait for the passage of time, for the generations to pass, for each one to produce more genetically healed humans, or, as you currently know them, the Divergent. Ever since Tori told me the word for what I am, Divergent, I have wanted to know what it means. And here is the simplest answer I have received. Divergent means that my genes are healed, pure, whole. I should feel relieved to know the real answer at last, but I just feel like something is off, itching in the back of my mind. I thought that Divergent explained everything that I am and everything that I could be. Maybe I was wrong. I am starting to feel short of breath as the revelations begin to work their way into my mind and heart. As David peels the layers of lies and secrets away, I touch my chest to feel my heartbeat, to try to steady myself. Your city is one of those experiments for genetic healing, and by far the most successful one, because of the behavioral modification portion. The factions, that is. David smiles at us, like it's something we should be proud of. But I am not proud. They created us. They shaped our world. They told us what to believe. If they told us what to believe, and we didn't come to it on our own, is it still true? I press my hand harder against my chest. Steady. The factions were our predecessors' attempt to incorporate a nurture element to the experiment. They discovered that mere genetic correction was not enough to change the way people behaved. A new social order, combined with the genetic modification, was determined to be the most complete solution to the behavioral problems that the genetic damage had created. David's smile fades as he looks around at all of us. I don't know what he expected. For us to smile back? He continues. The factions were later introduced to most of our other experiments, three of which are currently active. We have gone to great lengths to protect you, observe you, and learn from you. Kara runs her hands over her hair, as if checking for loose strands. Finding none, she says, So, when Edith Pryor said we were supposed to determine the cause of divergence and come out and help you, that was... Divergent is the name we decided to give to those who have reached the desired level of genetic healing, says David. We wanted to make sure that the leaders of your city valued them. We didn't expect the leader of Erudite to start hunting them down, or for the abnegation to even tell her what they were. And contrary to what Edith Pryor said, we never really intended for you to send a divergent army out to us. We don't, after all, truly need your help. We just need your healed genes to remain intact and to be passed on to future generations. So, what you're saying is that if we're not divergent, we're damaged? Caleb says. His voice is shaking. I never thought I would see Caleb on the verge of tears because of something like this. But he is. Steady, I tell myself again, and take another deep, slow breath. Genetically damaged, yes, says David. However, we were surprised to discover that the behavioral modification component of our city's experiment was quite effective. Up until recently, it actually helped quite a bit with the behavioral problems that made the genetic manipulation so problematic to begin with. So generally, you would not be able to tell whether a person's genes were damaged or healed from their behavior. I'm smart, Caleb says. So you're saying that because my ancestors were altered to be smart, I, their descendant, can't be fully compassionate? I, and every other genetically damaged person, am limited by my damaged genes, and the divergent are not. Well, says David, lifting a shoulder. Think about it. Caleb looks at me for the first time in days, and I stare back. Is that the explanation for Caleb's betrayal? His damaged genes? Like a disease that he can't heal and can't control? It doesn't seem right. Genes aren't everything, Amar says. People, even genetically damaged people, make choices. That's what matters. I think of my father, a born erudite, not divergent, a man who cannot help but be smart, choosing abnegation, engaging in a lifelong struggle against his own nature, and ultimately fulfilling it. A man warring with himself, just as I war with myself. That internal war doesn't seem like a product of genetic damage. It seems completely, purely human. I look at Tobias. He is so washed out, so slouched, he looks like he might pass out. He's not alone in his reaction. Christina, Peter, Uriah, and Caleb all look stunned. Kara has the hem of her shirt pinched between her fingers, and she is moving her thumb over the fabric, frowning. This is a lot to process, says David. That is an understatement. Beside me, Christina snorts. And you've all been up all night, David finishes, like there was no interruption. So, I'll show you to a place where you can get some rest and food. Wait, I say. I think of the photograph in my pocket, and how Zoe knew my name when she gave it to me. I think of what David said, about observing us and learning from us. I think of the rows of screens, blank, right in front of me. You said you've been observing us. How? Zoe purses her lips. David nods to one of the people at the desks behind him. All at once, all the screens turn on, each of them showing footage from different cameras. On the ones nearest to me, I see Dauntless Headquarters, the Merciless Mart, Millennium Park, the Hancock Building, the Hub. You've always known that the Dauntless observe the city with security cameras, David says. Well, we have access to those cameras too. They've been watching us. I think about leaving. We walk past the security checkpoint on our way to wherever David is taking us, and I think about walking through it again, picking up my gun and running from this place where they've been watching me since I was small. My first steps, my first words, my first day of school, my first kiss. Watching when Peter attacked me, when my faction was put under a simulation and turned into an army, when my parents died. What else have they seen? The only thing that stops me from going is the photograph in my pocket. I can't leave these people before I find out how they knew my mother. David takes us through the compound to a carpeted area with potted plants on either side. The wallpaper is old and yellowed, peeling from the corners of the walls. We follow him into a large room with high ceilings and wood floors and lights that glow orange-yellow. There are cots arranged in two straight rows, with trunks beside them for what we brought with us, and large windows with elegant curtains on the opposite end of the room. When I get closer to them, I see that they're worn and frayed at the edges. David tells us that this part of the compound was a hotel, connected to the airport by a tunnel, and this room was once the ballroom. Again, the words mean nothing to us, but he doesn't seem to notice. This is just a temporary dwelling, of course. Once you decide what to do, we will settle you somewhere else, whether it's in this compound or elsewhere. Zoe will ensure that you are well taken care of, he says. I will be back tomorrow to see how you're all doing. I look back at Tobias, who is pacing back and forth in front of the windows, gnawing on his fingernails. I never realized he had that habit. Maybe he was never distressed enough to do it before. I could stay and try to comfort him, but I need answers about my mother, and I'm not going to wait any longer. I'm sure that Tobias, of all people, will understand. I follow David into the hallway. Just outside the room, he leans against the wall and scratches the back of his neck. Hi, I say. My name is Triss. I believe you knew my mother. He jumps a little, but eventually smiles at me. I cross my arms. I feel the same way I did when Peter pulled my towel away during Dauntless initiation to be cruel. Exposed, embarrassed, angry. Maybe it's not fair to direct all of that at David, but I can't help it. He's the leader of this compound, of the Bureau. Yes, of course, he says. I recognize you. From where? The creepy cameras that followed my every move? I pull my arms tighter across my chest. Right. I wait a beat, then say, I need to know about my mother. Zoe gave me a picture of her, and you were standing right next to her in it, so I figured you could help. Ah, he says. Can I see the picture? I take it out of my pocket and offer it to him. He smooths it down with his fingertips, and there's a strange smile on his face as he looks at it, like he's caressing it with his eyes. I shift my weight from one foot to the other. I feel like I'm intruding on a private moment. She took a trip back to us once, he says, before she settled into motherhood. That's when we took this. Back to you? I say. Was she one of you? Yes, David says simply, like it's not a word that changes my entire world. She came from this place. We sent her into the city when she was young to resolve a problem in the experiment. So she knew, I say, and my voice shakes, but I don't know why. She knew about this place, and what was outside the fence. David looks puzzled, his bushy eyebrows furrowed. Well, of course. The shaking moves down my arms and into my hands, and soon my entire body is shuddering, as if rejecting some kind of poison that I've swallowed, and the poison is knowledge. The knowledge of this place, and its screens, and all the lies I built my life on. She knew you were watching us at every moment, watching as she died, and my father died, and everyone started killing each other. And did you send in someone to help her, to help me? No. No, all you did was take notes. Triss. He tries to reach for me, and I push his hand away. Don't call me that. You shouldn't know that name. You shouldn't know anything about us. Shivering, I walk back into the room. Back inside, the others have picked their beds and put their things down. It's just us in here, no intruders. I lean against the wall by the door and push my palms down the front of my pants to get the sweat off. No one seems to be adjusting well. Peter lies facing the wall. Uriah and Christina sit side by side, having a conversation in low voices. Caleb is massaging his temples with his fingertips. Tobias is still pacing and gnawing on his fingernails. And Kara is on her own, dragging her hand over her face. For the first time since I met her, she looks upset. The erudite armor gone. I sit down across from her. You don't look so good. Her hair, usually smooth and perfect and it's not, is disheveled. She glowers at me. That's kind of you to say. Sorry, I say. I didn't mean it that way. I know, she sighs. I'm an erudite, you know? I smile a little. Yeah, I know. No, Kara shakes her head. It's the only thing I am, erudite. And now they've told me that that's the result of some kind of flaw in my genetics, and that the factions themselves are just a mental prison to keep us under control. Just like Evelyn Johnson and the factionless said. She pauses. So why form the Allegiant? Why bother to come out here? I didn't realize how much Kara had already cleaved to the idea of being an Allegiant, loyal to the faction system. Loyal to our founders. For me, it was just a temporary identity. Powerful because it could get me out of the city. For her, the attachment must have been much deeper. It's still good that we came out here, I say. We found out the truth. That's not valuable to you? Of course it is, Kara says softly. But it means I need other words for what I am. Just after my mother died, I grabbed hold of my divergence, like it was a hand outstretched to save me. I needed that word to tell me who I was when everything else was coming apart around me. But now, I'm wondering if I need it anymore. If we ever really need these words. Dauntless, erudite, divergent, allegiant. Or if we can just be friends or lovers or siblings. Defined instead by the choices we make and the love and loyalty that binds us. Better check on him, Kara says, nodding to Tobias. Yeah, I say. I cross the room and stand in front of the windows, staring at what we can see of the compound, which is just more of the same glass and steel, pavement and grass and fences. When he sees me, he stops pacing and stands next to me instead. "You all right?" I say to him. "Yeah." He sits on the windowsill, facing me, so we're at eye level. "I mean, no, not really. Right now I'm just thinking about how meaningless it all was. The faction system, I mean." He rubs the back of his neck, and I wonder if he's thinking about the tattoos on his back. "We put everything we had into it," he says. "All of us, even if we didn't realize we were doing it." "That's what you're thinking about?" I raise my eyebrows. "Tobias, they were watching us. Everything that happened, everything we did. They didn't intervene. They just invaded our privacy, constantly." He rubs his temple with his fingertips. "I guess. That's not what's bothering me, though." I must give him an incredulous look, without meaning to, because he shakes his head. "Tris, I worked in the Dauntless control room. There were cameras everywhere, all the time. I tried to warn you that people were watching you during your initiation, remember?" I remember his eyes shifting to the ceiling, to the corner, his cryptic warnings hissed between his teeth. I never realized he was warning me about cameras. It just never occurred to me before. "It used to bother me," he says, "but I got over it a long time ago. We always thought we were on our own, and now it turns out we were right. They left us on our own. That's just the way it is." "I guess I don't accept that," I say. "If you see someone in trouble, you should help them, experiment or not. And, God," I cringe, "all the things they saw." He smiles at me a little. "What?" I demand. "I was just thinking of some of the things they saw," he says, putting his hand on my waist. I glare at him for a moment, but I can't sustain it. Not with him grinning at me like that. Not knowing that he's trying to make me feel better. I smile a little. I sit next to him on the windowsill, my hands wedged between my legs and the wood. "You know, the Bureau setting up the factions is not much different than what we thought happened. A long time ago, a group of people decided that the faction system would be the best way to live, or the way to get people to live the best lives they could." He doesn't respond at first, just chews on the inside of his lip and looks at our feet, side by side on the floor. My toes brush the ground, not quite reaching it. "That helps, actually," he says. "But there's so much that was a lie. It's hard to figure out what was true. What was real? What matters?" I take his hand, slipping my fingers between his. He touches his forehead to mine. I catch myself thinking, "Thank God for this." Out of habit, and then I understand what he's so concerned about. What if my parents' God, their whole belief system, is just something concocted by a bunch of scientists to keep us under control? And not just their beliefs about God and whatever else is out there, but about right and wrong, about selflessness. Do all those things have to change because we know how our world was made? I don't know. The thought rattles me, so I kiss him, slowly, so I can feel the warmth of his mouth and the gentle pressure and his breaths as we pull away. "Why is it," I say, "that we always find ourselves surrounded by people?" "I don't know," he says. "Maybe because we're stupid." I laugh, and it's laughter, not light, that casts out the darkness building within me, that reminds me I am still alive, even in this strange place where everything I've ever known is coming apart. I know some things. I know that I'm not alone, that I have friends, that I'm in love. I know where I came from. I know that I don't want to die. And for me, that's something. More than I could have said a few weeks ago. That night, we push our cots just a little closer together and look into each other's eyes in the moments before we fall asleep. When he finally drifts off, our fingers are twisted together in the space between the beds. I smile a little and let myself go too.
Chapter 16. Tobias. The sun still hasn't completely set when we fall asleep, but I wake a few hours later at midnight, my mind too busy for rest, swarming with thoughts and questions and doubts. Triss released me earlier, and her fingers now brush the floor. She is sprawled over the mattress, her hair covering her eyes. I shove my feet into my shoes and walk the hallways, shoelaces slapping the carpets. I am so accustomed to the dauntless compound that I am not used to the creak of wooden floors beneath me. I am used to the scrape and echo of stone, and the roar and pulse of water in the chasm. A week into my initiation, Amar, worried that I was becoming increasingly isolated and obsessive, invited me to join some of the older dauntless for a game of dare. For my dare, we went back to the pit for me to get my first tattoo. The patch of dauntless flames covering my ribcage. It was agonizing. I relished every second of it. I reach the end of one hallway and find myself in an atrium, surrounded by the smell of wet earth. Everywhere plants and trees are suspended in water, the same way they were in the Amity greenhouses. In the center of the room is a tree and a giant water tank, lifted high above the floor so I can see the tangle of roots beneath it. Strangely human, like nerves. "You're not nearly as vigilant as you used to be," Amar says from behind me. "Followed you all the way here from the hotel lobby." "What do you want?" I tap the tank with my knuckles, sending ripples through the water. "I thought you might like an explanation for why I'm not dead," he says. "I thought about it," I say. "They never let us see your body. It wouldn't be that hard to fake a death if you never show the body." "Sounds like you've got it all figured out." Amar claps his hands together. "Well, I'll just go then, if you're not curious." I cross my arms. Amar runs a hand over his black hair, tying it back with a rubber band. "They faked my death because I was divergent, and Janine had started killing the divergent. They tried to save as many as they could before she got to them, but it was tricky, you know, because she was always a step ahead." "Are there others?" I say. "A few," he says. "Any named Pryor?" Amar shakes his head. "No, Natalie Pryor is actually dead, unfortunately. She was the one who helped me get out. She also helped this other guy, too, George Wu. Know him? He's on patrol right now, or he would have come with me to get you. His sister is still inside the city." The name clutches at my stomach. "Oh, God," I say, and I lean into the tank wall. "What? You know him?" I shake my head. "I can't imagine it. There were just a few hours between Tori's death and our arrival. On a normal day, a few hours can contain long stretches of watch checking, of empty time. But yesterday, just a few hours placed an impenetrable barrier between Tori and her brother." "Tori is his sister," I say. "She tried to leave the city with us."
"Tried to?" repeats Amar.
"Ah, wow, that's..." Both of us are quiet for a while. "George will never get to reunite with his sister, and she died thinking he had been murdered by Janine." There isn't anything to say, at least not anything that's worth saying. Now that my eyes have adjusted to the light, I can see that the plants in this room were selected for beauty, not practicality. Flowers and ivy and clusters of purple or red leaves. The only flowers I've ever seen are wildflowers, or apple blossoms in the Amity orchards. These are more extravagant than those, vibrant and complex, petals folded into petals. Whatever this place is, it has not needed to be as pragmatic as our city. "That woman who found your body," I say, "was she just lying about it?" "People can't really be trusted to lie consistently," he quirks his eyebrows. "Never thought I would say that phrase. It's true, anyway.
She was reset. Her memory was altered to include me jumping off the pyre, and the body that was planted wasn't actually me, but it was too messed up for anyone to notice. She was reset. You mean with the abnegation serum? We call it memory serum, since it doesn't technically just belong to the abnegation, but yeah, that's the one. I was angry with him before. I'm not really sure why. Maybe I was just angry that the world had become such a complicated place, that I have never known even a fraction of the truth about it, or that I allowed myself to grieve for someone who was never really gone, the same way I grieved for my mother all the years I thought she was dead. Tricking someone into grief is one of the cruelest tricks a person can play, and it's been played on me twice. But as I look at him, my anger ebbs away like the changing of the tide. And standing in the place of my anger is my initiation instructor and friend, alive again. I grin. So you're alive, I say. More importantly, he says, pointing at me, you are no longer upset about it. He grabs my arm and pulls me into an embrace, slapping my back with one hand. I try to return his enthusiasm, but it doesn't come naturally. When we break apart, my face is hot. And judging by how he bursts into laughter, it's also bright red. Once a stiff, always a stiff, he says. Whatever, I say. So do you like it here, then? Amar shrugs. I don't really have a choice. But yeah, I like it fine. I work in security, obviously, since that's all I was trained to do. We'd love to have you, but you're probably too good for it. I haven't quite resigned myself to staying here just yet, I say. But thanks, I guess. There's nowhere better out there, he says. All the other cities, that's where most of the country lives in these big metropolitan areas like our city, are dirty and dangerous unless you know the right people. Here, at least, there's clean water and food and safety. I shift my weight, uncomfortable. I don't want to think about staying here, making this my home. I already feel trapped by my own disappointment. This is not what I imagined when I thought of escaping my parents and the bad memories they gave me, but I don't want to disturb the peace with Amar now that I finally feel like I have my friend back, so I just say, I'll take that under advisement. Listen, there's something else you should know. What, more resurrections? It's not exactly a resurrection if I was never dead, is it? Amar shakes his head. No. It's about the city. Someone heard it in the control room today. Marcus's trial is scheduled for tomorrow morning. I knew it was coming. I knew Evelyn would save him for last, would savor every moment she spent watching him squirm under truth serum like he was her last meal. I just didn't realize that I would be able to see it if I wanted to. I thought I was finally free of them. All of them. Forever. Oh, is all I can say. I still feel numb and confused when I walk back to the dormitory later and crawl back into bed. I don't know what I'll do.
Chapter 17. Triss. I wake just before the sun. No one else stirs in their cot. Tobias's arm is draped over his eyes, but his shoes are now on, like he got up and walked around in the middle of the night. Christina's head is buried beneath her pillow. I lay for a few minutes, finding patterns in the ceiling, then put on my shoes and run my fingers through my hair to flatten it. The hallways in the compound are empty, except for a few stragglers. I assume they are just finishing the night shift, because they are hunched over screens, their chins propped on their hands, or slumped against broomsticks, barely remembering to sweep. I put my hands in my pockets and follow the signs to the entrance. I want to get a better look at the sculpture I saw yesterday. Whoever built this place must have loved light. There is glass in the curve of each hallway's ceiling and along each lower wall. Even now, when it is barely morning, there is plenty of light to see by. I check my back pocket for the badge Zoe handed to me at dinner last night, and pass the security checkpoint with it in hand. Then I see the sculpture, a few hundred yards away from the doors we entered through yesterday, gloomy and massive and mysterious, like a living entity. It is a huge slab of dark stone, square and rough, like the rocks at the bottom of the chasm. A large crack runs through the middle of it, and there are streaks of lighter rock near the edges. Suspended above the slab is a glass tank of the same dimensions, full of water. A light placed above the center of the tank shines through the water, refracting as it ripples. I hear a faint noise, a drop of water hitting the stone. It comes from a small tube running through the center of the tank. At first, I think the tank is just leaking, but another drop falls, then a third, and a fourth, at the same interval. A few drops collect, and then disappear down a narrow channel in the stone. They must be intentional. Hello. Zoe stands on the other side of the sculpture. I'm sorry. I was about to go to the dormitory for you, then saw you heading this way and wondered if you were lost. No, I'm not lost, I say. This is where I meant to go. Ah. She stands beside me and crosses her arms. She is about as tall as I am, but she stands straighter, so she seems taller. Yeah, it's pretty weird, right? As she talks, I watch the freckles on her cheeks, dappled like sunlight through dense leaves. Does it mean something? It's the symbol of the Bureau of Genetic Welfare, she says. The slab of stone is the problem we're facing. The tank of water is our potential for changing that problem. And the drop of water is what we're actually able to do, at any given time. I can't help it. I laugh. Not very encouraging, is it? She smiles. That's one way of looking at it. I prefer to look at it another way, which is that if they are persistent enough, even tiny drops of water, over time, can change the rock forever, and it will never change back. She points to the center of the slab, where there is a small impression, like a shallow bowl carved into the stone. That, for example, wasn't there when they installed this thing. I nod and watch the next drop fall. Even though I'm wary of the Bureau and everyone in it, I can feel the quiet hope of the sculpture working its way through me. It's a practical symbol, communicating the patient attitude that has allowed the people here to stay for so long, watching and waiting. But I have to ask, wouldn't it be more effective to unleash the whole tank at once? I imagine the wave of water colliding with the rock and spilling over the tile floor, collecting around my shoes. Doing a little at once can fix something, eventually. But I feel like when you believe that something is truly a problem, you throw everything you have at it, because you just can't help yourself. Momentarily, she says. But then we wouldn't have any water left to do anything else. And genetic damage isn't the kind of problem that can be solved with one big charge. I understand that, I say. I'm just wondering if it's a good thing to resign yourself quite this much to small steps when you could take some big ones. Like what? I shrug. I guess I don't really know, but it's worth thinking about. Fair enough. So, you said you were looking for me, I say. Why? Oh, Zoe touches her forehead. It slipped my mind. David asked me to find you and take you to the labs. There's something there that belonged to your mother. My mother? My voice comes out sounding strangled and too high. She leads me away from the sculpture and toward the security checkpoint again. Fair warning, you might get stared at, Zoe says as we walk through the security scanner. There are more people in the hallways up ahead now than there were earlier. It must be time for them to start work. Your face is a familiar one here. People in the Bureau watch the screens often, and for the past few months, you've been involved in a lot of interesting things. A lot of the younger people think you're downright heroic. Oh, good, I say, a sour taste in my mouth. Heroism is what I was focused on, not, you know, trying not to die. Zoe stops. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to make light of what you've been through. I still feel uncomfortable with the idea that everyone has been watching us, like I need to cover myself or hide where they can't look at me anymore. But there's not much Zoe can do about it, so I don't say anything. Most of the people walking the halls wear variations of the same uniform. It comes in dark blue or dull green, and some of them wear the jackets or jumpsuits or sweatshirts open, revealing t-shirts of a wide variety of colors, some with pictures drawn on them. Do the colors of the uniforms mean anything? I ask Zoe. Yes, actually. Dark blue means scientist or researcher, and green means support staff. They do maintenance, upkeep, things like that. So they're like the factionless. No, she says. No, the dynamic is different here. Everyone does what they can to support the mission. Everyone is valued and important. She was right. People do stare at me. Most of them just look at me for a little too long, but some point, and some even say my name, like it belongs to them. It makes me feel cramped, like I can't move the way I want to. A lot of the support staff used to be in the experiment in Indianapolis, another city, not far from here, Zoe says. But for them, this transition has been a little bit easier than it will be for you. Indianapolis didn't have the behavioral components of your city. She pauses. The factions, I mean. After a few generations, when your city didn't tear itself apart, and the others did, the Bureau implemented the faction components in the newer cities, St. Louis, Detroit, and Minneapolis, using the relatively new Indianapolis experiment as a control group. The Bureau always placed experiments in the Midwest, because there's more space between urban areas here. Out east, everything is closer together. So, in Indianapolis, you just corrected their genes and shoved them in a city somewhere? Without factions? They had a complex system of rules, but yes, that's essentially what happened. And it didn't work very well. No. She purses her lips. Genetically damaged people who have been conditioned by suffering and are not taught to live differently, as the factions would have taught them to, are very destructive. That experiment failed quickly. Within 3 generations, Chicago, your city, and the other cities that have factions have made it through much more than that. Chicago. It's so strange to have a name for the place that was always just home to me. It makes the city smaller in my mind. So, you guys have been doing this for a long time, I say. Quite some time, yes. The Bureau is different from most government agencies because of the focused nature of our work and our contained, relatively remote location. We pass on knowledge and purpose to our children instead of relying on appointments or hiring. I've been training for what I'm doing now for my entire life. Through the abundant windows, I see a strange vehicle. It's shaped like a bird, with 2 wing structures and a pointed nose, but it has wheels like a car. Is that for air travel? I say, pointing at it. Yes, she smiles. It's an airplane. We might be able to take you up in one sometime, if it doesn't seem too daunting for you. I don't react to the play on words. I can't quite forget how she recognized me on sight. David is standing near one of the doors up ahead. He raises his hand in a wave when he sees us. Hello, Triss, he says. Thank you for bringing her, Zoe. You're welcome, sir, Zoe says. I'll leave you to it, then. Lots of work to do. She smiles at me, then walks away. I don't want her to leave. Now that she's gone, I'm left with David and the memory of how I yelled at him yesterday. He doesn't say anything about it, just scans his badge in the door sensor to open it. The room beyond it is an office with no windows, A young man, maybe Tobias's age, sits at one desk, and another one, across the room, is empty. The young man looks up when we come in, taps something on his computer screen, and stands.
"Hello, sir," he says. "Can I help you?"
"Matthew."
"Where's your supervisor?" David says.
"He's foraging for food in the cafeteria," Matthew says.
"Well, maybe you can help me then. I'll need Natalie Wright's file loaded on a portable screen. Can you do that?"
Wright, I think. Was that my mother's real last name?
"Of course," Matthew says, and he sits again. He types something on his computer and pulls up a series of documents that I'm not close enough to see clearly.
"Okay. It just has to transfer."
"You must be Natalie's daughter, Beatrice."
He props his chin on his hand and looks at me critically. His eyes are so dark they look black, and they slant a little at the edges. He does not look impressed or surprised to see me.
"You don't look much like her."
"Triss," I say automatically, but I find it comforting that he doesn't know my nickname. That must mean he doesn't spend all his time staring at the screens like our lives in the city are entertainment.
"And yeah, I know." David pulls a chair over, letting it screech on the tile, and pats it.
"Sit. I'll give you a screen with all Natalie's files on it so that you and your brother can read them yourselves. But while they're loading, I might as well tell you the story."
I sit on the edge of the chair, and he sits behind the desk of Matthew's supervisor, turning a half-empty coffee cup in circles on the metal.
"Let me start by saying that your mother was a fantastic discovery. We located her, almost by accident, inside the damaged world, and her genes were nearly perfect." David beams. "We took her out of a bad situation and brought her here. She spent several years here. But then we encountered a crisis within your city's walls, and she volunteered to be placed inside to resolve it. I'm sure you know all about that, though."
For a few seconds, all I can do is blink at him. My mother came from outside this place? Where? It hits me again that she walked these halls, watched the city on the screens in the control room. Had she sat in this chair? Had her feet touched these tiles? Suddenly, I feel like there are invisible marks of my mother everywhere, on every wall and doorknob and pillar. I grip the edge of the seat and try to organize my thoughts enough to ask a question.
"No, I don't know," I say. "What crisis?" "The erudite representative had just begun to kill the divergent, of course," he says. "His name was Norman?
Norton," says Matthew.
"Janine's predecessor. Seems he passed on the idea of killing off the divergent to her right before his heart attack."
"Thank you. Anyway, we sent Natalie in to investigate the situation and to stop the deaths. We never dreamed she would be in there for so long, of course. But she was useful. We had never thought about having an insider before. And she was able to do many things that were invaluable to us, as well as building a life for herself, which obviously includes you."
I frown. "But the divergent were still being killed when I was an initiate."
"You only know about the ones who died," David says, "not about the ones who didn't die. Some of them are here, in this compound. I believe you met Amar earlier. He's one of them. Some of the rescued divergent needed some distance from your experiment. It was too hard for them to watch the people they had once known and loved going about their lives, so they were trained to integrate into life outside the Bureau. But yes, she did important work, your mother."
"She also told quite a few lies, and very few truths. I wonder if my father knew who she was, where she was really from. He was an abnegation leader, after all, and as such, one of the keepers of the truth." I have a sudden, horrifying thought. What if she only married him because she was supposed to, as part of her mission in the city?
What if their entire relationship was a sham? So, she wasn't really born dauntless, I say, as I sort through the lies that must have been. When she first entered the city, it was as a dauntless, because she already had tattoos, and that would have been hard to explain to the natives. She was 16, but we said she was 15, so she would have some time to adjust. Our intention was for her to... He lifts a shoulder. Well, you should read her file. I can't do a 16-year-old perspective justice. As if on cue, Matthew opens a desk drawer and takes out a small, flat piece of glass. He taps it with one fingertip, and an image appears on it. It's one of the documents he just had open on his computer. He offers the tablet to me. It's sturdier than I expected it to be, hard and strong. Don't worry, it's practically indestructible, David says. I'm sure you want to return to your friends. Matthew, would you please walk Miss Pryor back to the hotel? I have some things to take care of. And I don't? Matthew says. Then he winks. Kidding, sir. I'll take her. Thank you, I say to David, before he walks out. Of course, he says. Let me know if you have any questions. Ready? Matthew says. He's tall, maybe the same height as Caleb, and his black hair is artfully tousled in the front, like he spent a lot of time making it look like he just rolled out of bed that way. Under his dark blue uniform, he wears a plain black t-shirt and a black string around his throat. It shifts over his Adam's apple when he swallows. I walk with him out of the small office and down the hallway again. The crowd that was here before has thinned. They must have settled into work or breakfast. There are whole lives being lived in this place, sleeping and eating and working, bearing children and raising families and dying. This is a place my mother called home once. I wonder when you're going to freak out, he says, after finding out all this stuff at once. I'm not going to freak out, I say, feeling defensive. I already did, I think, but I'm not going to admit to that. Matthew shrugs. I would, but fair enough. I see a sign that says hotel entrance up ahead. I clutch the screen to my chest, eager to get back to the dormitory and tell Tobias about my mother. Listen, one of the things my supervisor and I do is genetic testing, Matthew says. I was wondering if you and that other guy, Marcus Eaton's son, would mind coming in so that I can test your genes. Why? Curiosity, he shrugs. We haven't gotten to test the genes of someone in such a late generation of the experiment before. And you and Tobias seem to be somewhat odd in your manifestations of certain things. I raise my eyebrows. You, for example, have displayed extraordinary serum resistance. Most of the Divergent aren't as capable of resisting serums as you are, Matthew says. And Tobias can resist simulations, but he doesn't display some of the characteristics we've come to expect of the Divergent. I can explain in more detail later. I hesitate, not sure if I want to see my genes, or Tobias's genes, or to compare them, like it matters. But Matthew's expression seems eager, almost childlike, and I understand curiosity. I'll ask him if he's up for it, I say. But I would be willing. When? This morning, okay? He says. I can come get you in an hour or so. You can't get into the labs without me anyway. I nod. I feel excited, suddenly, to learn more about my genes, which feels like the same thing as reading my mother's journal. I will get pieces of her back.
Chapter 18. Tobias. It's strange to see people you don't know well in the morning, with sleepy eyes and pillow creases in their cheeks. To know that Christina is cheerful in the morning, and Peter wakes up with his hair perfectly flat, but Kara communicates only through a series of grunts, inching her way limb by limb toward coffee. The first thing I do is shower and change into the clothes they provided for us, which aren't much different from the clothes I am accustomed to, but all the colors are mixed together like they don't mean anything to the people here. And they probably don't. I wear a black shirt and blue jeans and try to convince myself that it feels normal, that I feel normal, that I am adapting. My father's trial is today. I haven't decided if I'm going to watch it or not. When I return, Triss is already fully dressed, perched on the edge of one of the cots like she's ready to leap to her feet at any moment, just like Evelyn. I grab a muffin from the tray of breakfast food that someone brought us and sit across from her. Good morning, you're up early. Yeah, she says, scooting her foot forward so it's wedged between mine. Zoe found me at that big sculpture thing this morning. David had something to show me. She picks up the glass screen resting on the cot beside her. It glows when she touches it, showing a document. It's my mother's file. She wrote a journal. A small one from the look of it, but still. She shifts like she's uncomfortable. I haven't looked at it much yet. So, I say, why aren't you reading it? I don't know. She puts it down and the screen turns off automatically. I think I'm afraid of it. Abnegation children rarely know their parents in any significant way, because abnegation parents never reveal themselves the way other parents do when their children grow to a particular age. They keep themselves wrapped in gray cloth armor and selfless acts, convinced that to share is to be self-indulgent. This is not just a piece of Triss's mother, recovered. It's one of the first and last honest glimpses Triss will ever get of who Natalie Pryor was. I understand, then, why she holds it like it's a magical object, something that could disappear in a moment, and why she wants to leave it undiscovered for a while, which is the same way I feel about my father's trial. It could tell her something she doesn't want to know. I follow her eyes across the room to where Caleb sits, chewing on a bite of cereal, morosely, like a pouting child. Are you going to show it to him? I say. She doesn't respond. Usually I don't advocate giving him anything, I say. But in this case, this doesn't really just belong to you. I know that, she says, a little tersely. Of course I'll show it to him, but I think I want to be alone with it first. I can't argue with that. Most of my life has been spent keeping information close, turning it over and over in my mind. The impulse to share anything is a new one. The impulse to hide, as natural as breathing. She sighs, then breaks a piece off the muffin in my hand. I flick her fingers as she pulls away. Hey, there are plenty more just 5 feet to your right. Then you shouldn't be so worried about losing some of yours, she says, grinning. Fair enough. She pulls me toward her by the front of my shirt and kisses me. I slip my hand under her chin and hold her still as I kiss her back. Then I notice that she's stealing another pinch of muffin, and I pull away, glaring at her. Seriously, I say, I'll get you one from that table. It'll only take me a second. She grins. So, there's something I wanted to ask you. Would you be up for undergoing a little genetic test this morning? The phrase, a little genetic test, strikes me as an oxymoron. Why? I say. Asking to see my genes feels a little like asking me to strip down. Well, this guy I met, Matthew is his name, works in one of the labs here, and he says they would be interested in looking at our genetic material for research, she says. And he asked about you, specifically, because you're sort of an anomaly. Anomaly? Apparently you display some divergent characteristics and you don't display others, she says. I don't know. He's just curious about it. You don't have to do it. The air around my head feels warmer and heavier. To alleviate the discomfort, I touch the back of my neck, scratching at my hairline. Sometime in the next hour or so, Marcus and Evelyn will be on the screens. Suddenly I know that I can't watch. So even though I don't really want to let a stranger examine the puzzle pieces that make up my existence, I say, sure, I'll do it. Great, she says, and she eats another pinch of my muffin. A piece of hair falls into her eyes, and I am brushing it back before she even notices it. She covers my hand with her own, which is warm and strong, and the corners of her mouth curl into a smile. The door opens, admitting a young man with slanted angular eyes and black hair. I recognize him immediately as George Wu, Tori's younger brother. Georgie was the name she called him. He smiles a giddy smile, and I feel the urge to back away, to put more space between me and his impending grief. "I just got back," he says, breathless. "They told me my sister set out with you guys, and..." Tris and I exchange a troubled look. All around us, the others are noticing George by the door and going quiet. The same kind of quiet you hear at an abnegation funeral. Even Peter, who I would expect to crave other people's pain, looks bewildered, shifting his hands from his waist to his pockets and back again. "And," George begins again, "why are you all looking at me like that?" Kara steps forward, about to bear the bad news, but I can't imagine Kara sharing it well, so I get up, talking over her. "Your sister did leave with us," I say. "But we were attacked by the factionless, and she didn't make it." There is so much that phrase doesn't say. How quick it was, and the sound of her body hitting the earth, and the chaos of everyone running into the night, stumbling over the grass. I didn't go back for her. I should have. Of all the people in our party, I knew Tori best, knew how tightly her hand squeezed the tattoo needle, and how her laugh sounded rough, like it had been scraped with sandpaper. George touches the wall behind him for stability. "What?" "She gave her life defending us," Tris says, with surprising gentleness. "Without her, none of us would have made it out." "She's dead?" George says weakly. He leans his entire body into the wall and his shoulders sag. I see Amar in the hallway, a piece of toast in his hand and a smile quickly fading from his face. He sets the toast down on the table by the door. "I tried to find you earlier to tell you," Amar says. Last night Amar said George's name so casually I didn't think they really knew each other. Apparently they do. George's eyes turn glassy, and Amar pulls him into an embrace with one arm. George's fingers are bent at harsh angles into Amar's shirt, the knuckles white with tension. I don't hear him cry, and maybe he doesn't. Maybe all he needs to do is hold on to something. I have only hazy memories of my own grief over my mother when I thought she was dead. Just the feeling that I was separate from everything around me, and this constant sensation of needing to swallow something. I don't know what it's like for other people. Eventually, Amar leads George out of the room, and I watch them walk down the hallway side by side, talking in low voices. I barely remember that I agreed to participate in a genetic test until someone else appears at the door to the dormitory. A boy. Or not really a boy, since he looks about as old as I am. He waves to Tris.
"Oh, that's Matthew," she says. "I guess we should get going."
She takes my hand and leads me toward the doorway. Somehow I missed her mentioning that Matthew wasn't a crusty old scientist. Or maybe she didn't mention it at all. "Don't be stupid," I think. Matthew sticks out his hand.
"Hi. It's nice to meet you. I'm Matthew."
"Tobias," I say, because four sounds strange here, where people would never identify themselves by how many fears they have.
"You too." "So, let's go to the labs, I guess," he says. "They're this way."
The compound is thick with people this morning, all dressed in green or dark blue uniforms that pool around the ankles or stop several inches above the shoe, depending on the height of the person. The compound is full of open areas that branch off the major hallways, like chambers of a heart, each marked with a letter and a number. And the people seem to be moving between them, some carrying glass devices like the one Tris brought back this morning, some empty-handed.
"What's with the numbers?" says Tris. "Just a way of labeling each area?"
"They used to be gates," says Matthew, meaning that each one has a door and a walkway that led to a particular airplane going to a particular destination.
When they converted the airport into a compound, they ripped out all the chairs people used to wait for their flights in and replaced them with lab equipment, mostly taken from schools in the city. This area of the compound is basically a giant laboratory.
What are they working on?
I thought you were just observing the experiments, I say, watching a woman rush from one side of the hallway to the other with a screen balanced on both palms like an offering. Beams of light stretch across the polished tile, slanting through the ceiling windows. Through the windows, everything looks peaceful. Every blade of grass trimmed and the wild trees swaying in the distance. And it's hard to imagine that people are destroying one another out there because of damaged genes or living under Evelyn's strict rules in the city we left. Some of them are doing that. Everything that they notice in all the remaining experiments has to be recorded and analyzed, so that requires a lot of manpower. But some of them are also working on better ways to treat the genetic damage, or developing the serums for their own use instead of the experiment's use. Dozens of projects. All you have to do is come up with an idea, gather a team together, and propose it to the council that runs the compound under David. They usually approve anything that isn't too risky.
Yeah, says Triss. Wouldn't want to take any risks.
She rolls her eyes a little. They have a good reason for their endeavors, Matthew says. Before the factions were introduced, and the serums with them, the experiments all used to be under near constant assault from within. The serums helped the people in the experiment to keep things under control, especially the memory serum. Well, I guess no one's working on that right now. It's in the weapons lab. Weapons lab. He says the words like they're fragile in his mouth. Sacred words.
So the Bureau gave us the serums in the beginning? Triss says.
Yes, he says. And then the erudite continued to work on them, to perfect them. Including your brother. To be honest, we got some of our serum developments from them, by observing them in the control room. Only they didn't do much with the memory serum, the abnegation serum. We did a lot more with that, since it's our greatest weapon.
A weapon, Triss repeats.
Well, it arms the cities against their own rebellions, for one thing. Erase people's memories, and there's no need to kill them. They just forget what they were fighting about. And we can also use it against rebels from the Fringe, which is about an hour from here. Sometimes Fringe dwellers try to raid, and the memory serum stops them without killing them.
That's... I start.
Still kind of awful? Matthew supplies. Yes, it is. But the higher-ups here think of it as our life support, our breathing machine. Here we are. I raise my eyebrows. He just spoke out against his own leader so casually I almost missed it. I wonder if that's the kind of place this is, where dissent can be expressed in public, in the middle of a normal conversation, instead of in secret spaces with hushed voices. He scans his card at a heavy door on our left, and we walk down another hallway, this one narrow and lit with pale fluorescent light. He stops at a door marked Gene Therapy Room 1. Inside, a girl with light brown skin and a green jumpsuit is replacing the paper that covers the exam table. This is Juanita, the lab technician. Juanita, this is...
Yeah, I know who they are, she says, smiling.
Out of the corner of my eye, I see Triss stiffen, chafing against the reminder that our lives have been on camera. But she doesn't say anything about it. The girl offers me her hand. Matthew's supervisor is the only person who calls me Juanita, except Matthew, apparently. I'm Nita. You'll need two tests prepared? Matthew nods. I'll get them. She opens a set of cabinets across the room and starts pulling things out. All of them are encased in plastic and paper and have white labels. The room is